both transmitting and reception. And then you tune your 28 meg tunable IF receiver from 28 to 28.2. You're really tuning 220 to 220.2, so to speak. That's the way his transverter used to work. Along came the FCC, who removed the 220 band from us and gave it to UPS, I think it was, United Postal Service, and they moved us up to the 222 band. They moved us 2 megacycles up. And one way to do it would be to buy a crystal that gets his radio on 194 megs instead of 192 megs. But to go out and buy a new crystal and fight with the International Crystal Company, pay lots of dollars, wait lots of time, hope it comes out with the right frequency, it's a bit of a hassle. And so what Paul did with, in his craftiness is that he just simply moved his tunable IF. Instead of tuning 28 to 29 megs, he made it tune 30 to, let's say, 31 megs. And so by way of the phase lock loop that was into his 746 Pro, he found ways of modifying it so it tuned to the higher frequency. And this is a classic situation where if you're a crafty enough electronic engineer, you can take almost any piece of electronics that exists and modify it for an adjacent frequency region, a different power output, a different mode of modulation, and so on. So he made that modification to his rig so they would tune above 30 megs. And whether or not Gordon knows it, he picked up another advantage. Many of the automatic noise figure indicators you can buy on the surplus market have an IF of 30 megacycles. So by him having a receiver that tunes to 30 megs, it is ideal to operate with an automatic noise figure indicator. And when you force the automatic noise figure indicator to operate down at 28 megs instead of 30 where it was designed, its performance degrades a little bit and lets you modify it. So getting back to the CB question that Joe asked us in the very beginning, you can see that a crafty electronic engineer type citizen band operator can take many pieces of electronics out there where the manufacturer has attempted to make it very difficult to modify it so that you can illegally be using it on the CB band. But let's face it, no matter what difficulty you put into something, you created a deterrent, but not an absolute guarantee that somebody isn't going to thwart your attempts and therefore make modifications. So that sort of closes that loop. So we did discuss that subject, Andy, and now back to my ears are burning here. Why in the world was KQRIW mentioned that article? After we finish with your discussion on the article, we'll go back to Howie and discuss standing wave ratio of stacked antennas. So you first, Andy, W2CDL, K2RIW.
All right, sir, very good. Dick, W2CDL. So now I'm clear. And for all those listening, the static you hear, again, is due to some wind conditions which have been increasing the past hour. I guess that storm is pulling away, and we're getting the backlash of the storm. Looks like the cold air is going to be coming in around it. And usually, due to all the antennas that are where this repeater is located, some of them could be causing some static conditions. So just bear with the repeater on that. All right. I'm happy your ears are burning. Just to mention, again, I received the January 2008 issue of QST yesterday in the mail. Yesterday was Saturday. And I did get it early this year. This month, rather. And yesterday I thumbed through it. I didn't have a chance to really look at the article that closely. And I'm just looking at it now since, you know, we'll talk about it a bit. And it's under the section of the world above 50 megacycles. And this is by T. Zimmerman, K3ZZ. And he has a monthly article regarding that. And this just simply says stacking. And without going into all the technical aspects and all the formulas, he talks about some basics and a website that I looked into by G3SEK, don't know the guy's name on here, and I've got to look it up again to get the guy's name, but I do have the website available, and it clearly shows a nice tutorial of how antennas should be stacked, what the capture area is, what the aperture area is, what they call it, the definitions of it, the formulas that go with it, and it's a very good site to go to It's his website, G3SEK, is, if you want to write it down, it's www.ifweph.co.uk/G3SEK/stacking/stacking2, that's the number 2.htm. Kind of a lengthy website. If you want to, Nick, I'll repeat it again. If you want that, let me just let it drop for a comment.
Yeah, G3SEK is Ian White in the United Kingdom. Apparently he's got an awful nice website, which you could give us to him one more time. And Gene Zimmerman, W3ZZZ, I know him very well. Whenever we go to any of the microwave conferences, I always run into him. And he's now the column moderator for the World Above 50 Meg, a beautiful article that was created by Dr. Ed Tilton, W1HDQ, I think it is. Not Dr. Ed Tilton, but Mr. Ed Tilton, the man who created the World Above 50 megacycles. I think in the mid-40s is when he created that, when he suddenly realized that above 50 megacycles, some very interesting things are going on. The noises that you're hearing in the background are PIM noises, P-I-M, stands for Passive Intermodulation Distortion. Many hams call it the scratchies, call it the rusty nail phenomenon. Whenever you amplitude modulate or phase modulate a signal, you will be creating side lobes that you can see on a spectrum analyzer. The spectrum becomes more wide. And so if there's anything that is changing in conductivity in the vicinity of an antenna, because the wind is waving the antenna and things on the roof are moving, you're getting things that are coming in contact and breaking contact. The rusty bolt phenomenon, which creates an extremely minor amount of amplitude or phase modulation. However, a single site repeater, a repeater that is transmitting and receiving from the same antenna, has an extremely large power spread, which really pushes the state of the art. A good transmitter for a repeater is putting out, we'll say, 100 watts, which is plus 50 dBm. The receiver has a sensitivity of, let's say, minus 130 dBm. That's 180 decibels between the transmit power and the receive power. The ratio between the two is 1 with 18 zeros after it, or 17 zeros after it. Huge ratio of power. So therefore, you've got an extremely sensitive receiver right alongside us, connected to the exact same transmitter that is transmitting an extreme amount of power by the same token, so that any minor modification, any minor modulation of the signal in the area due to the wind waving the antenna makes these scratchy sounds. So unless everything is tied down perfectly on a windy day in a multi-repeater site, you're going to be hearing sounds like you're hearing right now. So A2CDL, A2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, exactly. Actually, I'm going in on a different input, so you may not hear it on my signal. My signal sounds pretty clean. But I do notice that the signal from the repeater is bouncing my S-meter all over the place. That's how much my antenna is moving, along with the antenna, the repeater's antenna is moving in the wind. So, okay. Anyway, just getting back to this discussion, or this article, is that he breaks it down into some basics of the key to stacking antennas is to obviously increase the effective gain of the antenna array. And again, if you go to this website, they give you, I think his name is Ian, you said, he will give you a complete discussion on it. And some of this information is taken directly from the website that I mentioned. He also talks about calculating effective aperture and how to do that. And there is a formula that is used, which is also on the website. If you have a Yagi antenna that is 10 elements or more, and a boom length of at least 2 wavelengths long, there is another well-known ham, Gunther Hawk, who is VO6WU, that there's a formula he created that will you use to optimize the stacking distance of the antennas, and he shows some pictures of how the taxi areas look like two ellipses on top of each other if you have two horizontal antennas mounted on the same mast. And the antennas, by the way, should be matched. They don't recommend using different green antennas. They say whenever you stack antennas, the antennas themselves should be identical or close to it due to the radiation pattern and beamers of the antennas. And the picture actually shows it clearly that the taxi areas should be just touching each other in a vertical position. In other words, if you have two antennas in the same mast on top of each other, once you calculate the aperture or capture area for each antenna, and you know the distance of that, then you space the antennas so electrically they should just be touching for maximum gain. He also talks about stacking antennas on different bands, and it's interesting because he goes on to say, and this is where your name comes in with a few other hams, Dick. He actually shows where you can have a higher frequency and a lower frequency antenna in the same band. And I'll just see if I can just find what I want to read here. Just give me just a minute here. I'm just going to look. Let's see. Because I'm looking at the picture here. Let me see the goal. So, capture and overlap. Alright, I'm just talking to myself here. Don't want to waste that much time doing that. But they do say, much of the literature suggests, and this is important, that one practical solution to stacking antennas on different bands on the same mast is that the higher frequency antenna lies inside, and that's the key, inside the capture area of the lower frequency antenna. And Dick, you could talk about this too. But the lower band antenna, the lower frequency antenna, lies just outside of the capture area of the higher band antenna. And they show that figure of two antennas within the capture area of each one. And they use a formula by W1JR to calculate the effective capture area of this particular antenna. And they used K1FO, his design, as a model for the stacking distance for these antennas. They used the 144-12, I guess it's a 12-element K1FO design Yagi antenna, 12-element 2-meter beam with a 17.3 foot boom. And there were three different methods. One is the manufacturer recommended. One is the DL6WU method, which has a certain stacking distance, and one is the W1JR. And he says that in discussion, and I'll quote this, in discussion with W1JR and K8ISK, however, they affirm that I have always used as an absolute minimum a half a wavelength, or approximately 1 meter, which is 39 inches, from the lower band antenna, as little as one can use. And then it says, in fact, both Dick, K2RIW, and Kent, WA5BJB, tell me that even this can be violated in practice until the antennas are so close that there exists capacitive coupling between the elements of one antenna and the other. Thus, spacing as little as 2 feet between 6 and 2 meters, or 1.5 feet between 2 and 220 megs, and 1 foot between 220 and 432 are likely to work. So that was a discussion that they had with you, Dick, and that's where your name is mentioned. So I just thought I'd bring that out. Back to you. Any comments about this?
Very good. Looks like Gene quoted me quite exactly. Gene and I had that discussion most recently at the microwave update in Philadelphia 1 month ago. I think it was in October. I forgot the exact date, but microwave update I think it was the 9th annual, and we were having this exact discussion of stacking distances. Mr. Hare Yagi is a Gunter Hawk, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He's the guy who has spent most of a lifetime studying Yagis, what's the maximum gain you can get out of them. And he's got a beautiful formula he has published in the German magazine, which has been repeated in a number of places, where you tell him the length of the boom that you've got to work with, you tell him the frequency you're on, he'll tell you the maximum gain you can get out of that length of boom, irrespective of how many elements you put on there. Put the right number of elements with the right length of the elements and the right stacking distance between the elements along the boom, his formula will tell you how much gain you've got. Dr. Hawk also has a formula he has derived for proper stacking distance. Joe Reiser has another formula. I think Joe Reiser came out with a simpler formula earlier, and Joe Reiser's formula is good, but I think the later formulas by Gunter Hawk could be a little bit better. Joe and I have had some slight disagreements on that one. Both Kent Britton, W85EJB, from the Dallas area, Dallas, Texas area. He actually lives in Grand Prairie, Texas. And he, if you ever go to his website, W85EJB.com, you'll see some beautiful little printed circuit antennas you can buy for 432, 1296, 2 gigs, 3 gigs, 5 gigs, and so on. Even log periodics up there at very inexpensive prices. I have used a tremendous number of those antennas in a commercial experiment, believe it or not. One of my consulting clients needed a whole bunch of antennas at 900 megacycles, and I literally went out and bought dozens of these little printed circuit three-element Yagis from W85EJB, and noticed to carry on those experiments, and noticed to prove a particular concept, which eventually resulted in a patentable antenna of a modified design. So, stacking distance, there is no perfect stacking distance. It's a compromise. If you stack the distances between the antennas as wide as you can think of, and feed them correctly, you'll get the extra gain of the extra antennas. However, as you stack too widely, the pattern of the stacked array becomes more complicated. The main lobe becomes more narrow than you'd like it to be. The side lobes become stronger than you'd like it to be. As you move the stacking distance in closer, the pattern improves. The main lobe gets wider, the side lobes get weaker, but eventually you start overlapping areas between the antennas, and you lose a little bit of forward gain. So each person who has written a formula for the proper stacking distance is using a slightly different criteria for how much overlap you're willing to tolerate. As you stack the antennas on different bands, very, very close together, the major thing that I've discovered by all the experiments in my backyard is that you only run into a problem when the stacking distance is so close that the elements of the lower frequency coming close to the elements of the higher frequency add capacitance to the tips of those elements and detune that antenna. If you're willing to retune the higher frequency antenna, there is nothing stopping you from making the stacking distance zero. Let me repeat that. If you're smart enough, you can make the stacking distance zero. By that I mean you can have, let's say, a 432, a 2-meter Yagi with its elements properly spaced along the boom, and in the right location, you can put the elements on the same boom, the shorter elements for the 432 Yagi, in the middle of the 2-meter Yagi. You can do that. And you can compensate for the fact that some of the elements of the 432 Yagi will be located close to some of the elements of the 2-meter Yagi, and by the extra capacitance, they've been pulled to a lower frequency, you shorten those 432 elements appropriately so that that's on the right same frequency, and the 432 Yagi will give you full performance. A Yagi is a series of parasitic elements, each with the right center frequency, each with the right location. That's what makes it all work. And so the fact that there are interstitially diffused 2-meter elements in the 432 Yagi is only a minor perturbation if you're smart enough with the design. The design would become really easy if they were cross-polarized. Horizontal 2-meter elements and 432 vertically polarized elements on the same boom. There you wouldn't have to do anything fancy. But if you want the horizontal and horizontal, it could be done. So if you're smart enough, the tacking distance can be made zero. I didn't happen to mention that to Gene Zimmerman, W3ZZ, said when we were last together. Therefore, that didn't get published. So, sounds like a fun article. Looking forward to reading that. Now, as you bring the elements closer and closer together between, say, a 432 Yagi and a 2-meter Yagi, Howie was concerned about the fact that they will interact with each other. And yes, there's at least two different kinds of interaction. Number one, do the areas overlap? Yes, but if you're willing to do some retuning, that problem goes away. Number two, are there signals coming from one to the other? Absolutely, and without fancy filtering, there's no way to cancel that one. In other words, when you're transmitting on 2 meters, there will be some 2-meter energy roaring down the feed line for the 432 antenna, and vice versa. And so, depending on the sensitivity of the other receiver, the slim possibility exists that enough energy could be coupled between the two to create damage or overload to the other receiver. By way of proper filtering, bandpass filtering, you can make that problem go away. Number three, when you bring the elements real close together, when you get the 432 Yagi and a 2-meter Yagi real close together, the 2-meter Yagi won't even know the 432 Yagi is there. But the 432 Yagi will definitely know that the 2-meter Yagi is there, and his gain will change if you don't retune. His standing wave ratio and impedance match to the driven element will change. But that, again, is something that can be retuned. So, detuning or retuning the driven element to give you a very low standing wave ratio, and retuning all of the parasitic elements to give you back the same gain and pattern, for a guy that's smart enough, all of that is doable. The impact is there, but it can be compensated. I wonder if any of that is surprising to you, Howie. Howie, for a quick comment on that. H-U-R-A-W on the TechNet.
I have a question also, Jim.
Okay. Maybe Howie doesn't have a comment on that. And go ahead, Andy, with your further discussion.
You know, one thing this article doesn't mention is the power that's going to the antenna from the transmitter. It doesn't mention anything about that. So let's make up a scenario here, and then maybe you could explain it to me. Because we know, it says here that, of course, as we all know about antennas, they generate energy in three dimensions. For a horizontal antenna, the type generally used for most least signal VHF work, by the way, the plane parallel to the ground is called the E field or the electric field and contains the electric field vector. This is the equivalent of the azimuth pattern. The magnetic field or the H plane exists at right angles to the E plane, which we know, and contains the magnetic vector. This is the equivalent to the elevation pattern. Now, is it true that if you put 10 watts into an antenna, that the effective area of the E and H planes will widen if you go from 10 watts to 100 watts? Wouldn't the magnetic and electric field increase because you're putting higher power into an antenna? And if they do, wouldn't that affect the capture area's point between both antennas? And that's my question, because it doesn't mention anything about that, so maybe you can clarify that point.
Good question. And the answer is no. The effective capture area of an antenna, by the law of reciprocity, is something that exists within the design of the antenna itself. Whether it is transmitting low power, high power, on frequency, off frequency, receiving on frequency, receiving off frequency, those parameters are independent of what you're doing with the antenna. Yes, the effector capture area is going to be maximum on the frequency where the antenna is tuned. And if you set the receiver to a higher or lower frequency, the effector capture area will decrease a little bit, and in a known manner. The gain falls off when you're off to the side of where the antenna is tuned to. That's a given. But the effective capture area of the antenna is independent of transmit power. So if I've got a 432 Yagi stacked on top of a 2-meter Yagi, there's a certain coupling between the two. The coupling between the two, there's ways I can minimize it by way of filtering. There's ways I can minimize it by making mechanical changes to the antenna itself. The small amount of detuning that might exist if I've got extremely close coupling between the two, extremely close spacing. There's ways I can compensate for that. But the amount of decibels of cross-coupling is a fixed number. If for my particular mechanical arrangement, the signal that I transmit out of the 432 antenna gets coupled into the 2-meter antenna with a 20 decibel attenuation. I put 100 watts into the 432 antenna, and 1 watt of it ends up on the 2-meter antenna. That might be a realistic situation. That 20 decibels of coupling will be steady whether I'm running a milliwatt, a watt, or a kilowatt. It's still exactly 20 dB of coupling. So could you say that the effective area as a transmitting device is expanding as a function of power? The answer is no, because when the effective capture area gets bigger or smaller, by the laws of interferometry, that dictates a brand new antenna pattern. Any antenna that has a larger effective capture area must, by definition, have a smaller 3 dB beamwidth. And you and I know, Andy, that the beamwidth does not change as a function of whether or not I'm transmitting 1 watt or 100 watts. Same beamwidth. Or whether I'm receiving with a good receiver or a bad receiver. Or a receiver with a pad in front of it. I get the exact same pattern out of the antenna. So, no, the area is not changing. The coupling between the two is a fixed number independent of watts. Good common sense, and in this particular case, the common sense, I think, has led you astray, Andy. W-A-2-C-D-L, K-2-L-I-W.
Hey, why the comments?
Mel recognized Andy first. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, I knew you would say that. I just wanted a clarification because, you know, it defies what you would think would be true. If you increase, you know, if you have a magnetic field, if you put a voltage onto a coil that's producing a magnetic field, then you increase the voltage, the magnetic field will increase. By the formula, wouldn't that be true with antennas? So, of course, looking at this and looking at the capture area or aperture area, they call it, in relation to the EH planes, you would think that those planes would widen with a higher voltage or higher power. I'm going to say voltage in this case, going to the antenna, a higher peak-to-peak voltage of the RF. So that would change automatically the distance, but of course you're saying no because of the laws of reciprocity, which I understand also. So now why it does that, the laws of physics, we'll probably get a little bit complicated not to get into that discussion, but it's a common question because it would be a common sense question to ask, and that's why I asked that. Get back to you, then you can pick up now.
Yeah, I've got an explanation for this one, Andy. Assume I've got a solenoid coil in air, and I pour 1 ampere of current through that coil. You and I could, with iron filings, figure out exactly where the magnetic field lines exist. All of those magnetic field lines go out to infinity. And you've got a certain number of lines and certain strengths of those lines. If now I change the environment, I change the situation where instead of putting 1 amp through that solenoid coil, I put 2 amps. I'm not changing the field lines in any way. The field lines simply get stronger, but they have the exact same arrangement they used to have. They're in the exact same position with the exact same orientation. When I bring my sensing device, like a Hall effect device nearby, I'll admit that I will sense the magnetic field at a greater distance. I used to be able, with my Hall effect device, with 1 ampere flowing, sense the magnetic field 2 feet away, and now when I've got 2 amperes flowing, I can sense the magnetic field 4 feet away. It doesn't mean that the magnetic field went out further. The magnetic field went to the 4 foot distance before also, just that it was below the threshold of my particular sensing device. It doesn't mean it wasn't there, I just wasn't able to see it. I didn't have enough sensitivity. So you're not changing the configuration or the size of the magnetic field when you go to higher current. You're only changing the strength of those individual force lines of magnetic field. That's my way of looking at it. And the same thing happens with the electromagnetic field that takes place around an antenna. You're not changing the pattern of the antenna when you put more watts into it. You're just changing how far away you can be and send signal. K2KEY. K2RAW, you got it first there, Mel.
One more thing also. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, thank you. This is K2KEY. Well, I've had a bit of experience with stacking. My experiences were on 6 meters with Telerik 4LMC. And I had a number of observations. I made quite a number of observations, some very scientific testing, and never did anything with it other than having a whole bunch of piece of paper here. One time I was going to put it together and try to make it into some kind of concise type of an article, but, you know, not really that great at organizing things properly. So I figured rather than get a big rejection, I just left it here. But some of the observations I had with the 6 meters that, well, first of all, I used a switching arrangement. I found that it was very desirable to be able to switch. And I had what they call that time, it may be referred to some articles, you can call it the BLU switching net system, which means both lower or upper. And I found when I wanted a higher angle of radiation, the lower antenna by itself did best. When you wanted a lower angle of the radiation, no doubt that the combined stack worked better. All right, let's take that point first before I go any further with stacking bases and all that. What do you think of that statement so far, over?
Fantastic. You're both lower, upper. That's your version of what I call the zoom control. On that array of 16 Yagis I had on 432, I could decide to feed all 16 Yagis at once, one vertical string of four Yagis, or just the upper Yagi. I was modifying the pattern in three-dimensional space in order to zoom in and out. We're doing it by controlling the elevation angle of radiation on your 6 meter antennas. And we amateurs have made very little use of electronic beam-forming network, electronic steering. That's what you're talking about, Mel. Electronic steering, right on. You got to write an article on that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. Now, what I found, in order to make this work, there's more to it than that. Just stacking them was not just the answer, Dick. I found that I had to come up with a quarter wavelength matching transformer to make this thing really work. In other words, you just can't parallel up this thing. In fact, when I finally sort of came up with this idea and talking to Telrex, they were very nice. I knew a couple of the engineers there. He says, you're on to something. So my switching arrangement with a T with two quarter wavelength matching transformers to be able to get the desired effect of stacking, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay. If you had done it dumbly and simply, Mel, where you flipped a switch so that you transmitted with the upper antenna, flipped the switch, transmitted the lower antenna, or flipped both switches and you transmit with both antennas at the same time, and you simply put them in parallel, that would have been a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That would have been, before you did any impedance matching, a half dB of potential loss, not much of a problem. And by changing the line length to the upper antenna versus the lower antenna from the common point, you could have intentionally steered the beam a little bit above the horizon or below the horizon, even before you started counting ground reflection, if you wanted to. However, the Mel Schneider I know is a little bit more of a purist than that. He wouldn't tolerate putting two antennas in parallel and having a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Therefore, I know you came up with a more complicated arrangement so that when you flip those relays to transmit with both, I know you re-impedance matched it. And by the way, I did the same thing with my array of 4, my array of 1, or my array of 16. I put fancy impedance matching lines in the right place because I wanted it to come out perfect. I didn't have to do it, but I did it, and I didn't have to lose any sleep over that. That electronic steering you were doing, though, by changing stacking distance, by changing phase length line, by changing the impedance matching, by flipping those relays, boy, you can do all kinds of magic with that. You did it in elevation. Believe it or not, you could have also done it in azimuth. if you're willing to stack antennas side by side. I can see why Telrex would be interested in what you were doing. My guess is that was 15 or 20 years ago. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, no, it's more than 20. Right away, it went more than 20 years ago. Let's try around 30 plus. Now, I noticed two complications arose. First of all, a single Yagi antenna over ideal, let's say an over ideal ground system, is not the same as of course it is in free space. And it further is complicated when you stick the second Yagi. Now, the second Yagi, when I put it up there, according to Telrex, their original stacking was approximately one wavelength between these two beacons. They had it, they sold you, if you wanted, the stacking kit, which I didn't buy, because I wanted to really come up with my own situation. Their stacking kit was a static system. Once you installed that was it. You couldn't switch antennas one or the other. As they say, you could not have what they call the BLU system. Now, the stacking that I eventually wound up with was two wavelengths apart. Yet, I was able to detect, now I don't remember what experiment I did, but to some extent, the elements seemed to have some kind of a parasitically excited type of effect, Dick, between the beams. I think it looked like, to some extent, I guess you could say the elements would be somewhat what they call parasitically excited by the single-driven Yagi at that one time. Is that a normal observation? Go ahead.
Absolutely. And now you're getting into the fine details. If I had a single Yagi mounted on the mast, and I did a careful pattern measurement of azimuth and elevation, I know what I got. With the proper stacking distance, I add a second Yagi on top of the first, but I still keep feeding only the first Yagi on the bottom. And now I measure the antenna pattern in elevation again. Azimuth pattern will be unaffected. Elevation pattern will be slightly different. Even with the proper stacking distance, the lower Yagi is launching a little bit of signal that hits the parasitic elements of the upper Yagi, which does slightly change the antenna pattern. And depending on the tuning of that upper Yagi and the stacking distance to it, that slight perturbation could be aiding or hurting. But I think it's a second-order effect. The average person, it's called the cross-coupled between the elements effect on a phased array antenna. Every phased array antenna has cross-coupling between the elements that is undesired from the antenna designer's point of view. Mother Nature is not going to suddenly say, gee, the signal is going to go out a certain number of inches and die and not couple to the other antenna. You always have coupling between multiple elements of a phased array antenna. And if you're a smart enough antenna designer, you anticipate, you measure, and you compensate for the fact that there is cross-coupling. It's there. It's not a major phenomenon, but the next step is to investigate it and use it in your favor. Very few people have ever gone there. Even the people who are deep into the world of phased array antennas for military application, you'd be very disappointed to find out how much investigation of the cross-coupling effect has been investigated, measured, quantified, compensated. You'd be very disappointed when you look in the literature. Everybody wants to take a blind eye to that because they think it's complicated. Well, that's just a matter of attitude and altitude. K2KEY. You've been worrying about that 30 years ago. You were 30 years ahead of your time, K2LIW, the deck man.
This is K2KEY. Okay, another observation I had, that, in other words, when you start with a stacking of two beams, two Yagi, on the same frequency, basically tuned to the same frequency, in other words, you've got to now figure out computation that will not actually be relevant to one antenna, but now have to take fully into consideration, as you say, the parasitics, and I guess, is it part now also images of its local field also now become part of it? In other words, do you get this image in its local field, or was that something I was imagining, and I'll tell you what the effect was. Over.
Okay. Now, how do you quantify the perturbation effect by the presence of the second Yagi, which is passive? And by the way, the second passive Yagi will give you a very slightly different performance depending on how it is terminated. I'm feeding power into the lower Yagi. I've measured the elevation pattern, the azimuth pattern. I know what it is. I add a second Yagi with the proper stacking distance vertically above it. And I'm getting a small amount of perturbation of the elevation pattern because of the presence of the second Yagi, even though I'm not feeding power to it. However, what are you doing with the feed line of the second antenna? If the feed line to the second antenna is terminated with a short circuit, an open circuit, or a 50-ohm resistor, you'll get three different results. And even if you decide to terminate it with a short circuit, do you terminate it with a short circuit that is an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, an even number of quarter wavelengths long? In other words, a certain amount of signal transmitted by the lower Yagi is going to be picked up by the second Yagi above. That signal it picks up, a certain portion of it goes down the driven element, goes down the feed line. And if the feed line is a short circuit with a certain phase length, now that reflected energy is coming back to that upper antenna, being re-radiated in phase or out of phase, depending on the length of the cable. So if you put a short circuit on the unused Yagi and tune the length of it, that length of the short circuit, you're doing a phase corrector. You're doing a phase shifter. And that will change the performance. Nobody has even used that effect yet, Mark. I mean, not Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I had a relay box up there, Dick. So I had a number of different options. I could say I had that, what they call that BLU system, both lower or upper. And the switching relays, I had the option to switch either Yagi in or out and short it literally to ground so that the transformer I had on there, it was the matching network I used in the quarter wave transformer, basically would restore the operation as a single antenna. But the funny part that I ran into, and I started having questions, and I maybe didn't have the smart that much, you know, considering that I was, you know, more or less not a professional antenna engineer, in asking Telrex, and they said that there was another system that they had in experimentation, but never produced it because it didn't seem to be really a market in the amateur radio, but they said that they thought that it may have an application in military use, was be able to now switch. They had 3K switching, and I never looked into it. Maybe you can comment on it. Parallel, orthogonal, and anti-parallel switching arrangements. Have you ever heard of that type of switching arrangement, Dick? Over.
Absolutely. You'd be amazed how many amateurs fell into that trap by mistake. Take a guy that's going to stack two Yagis vertically, and he's a guy who is super symmetric oriented. He knows he's going to put a power divider on the mast midway between the upper Yagi and the lower Yagi. He wants to run the shortest piece of coax cable to each one of them. For some reason, he makes that decision. It is extremely tempting to mount the lower Yagi right side up and the upper Yagi upside down. And then the connectors are closest together. Two short pieces of cable go to the power divider. You'd be amazed how many guys have fallen into that trap. They didn't realize that when they took the upper Yagi and rotated 180 degrees around the axis of the boom, that they were switching the polarization from positive to negative. The net result is that the two vertically stacked antennas are now phase-wise out of phase with each other. And what does that do? That steers the vertical beamwidth pattern in such a way that you have a null on the horizon. You have a peak of energy above the horizon, a peak of energy below the horizon, but a null on the horizon. So the guys that were smart enough, who were talking to me at the time, and I was realizing that a signal strength meter was really terrible. I had calibrated my receiver in microvolts, and these guys were calling me up all the time saying, hey, how many microvolts is my signal today? And so the guy used to have one Yagi, and he had 47 microvolts. He now stacks two Yagis, and he expects the answer to be 80 microvolts, and he measures 5 microvolts. And he says, what in the world happened? And I asked him a bunch of questions, and we suddenly realized he went to supersymmetry by mistake. So you can see how you can steer a null on the horizon by making them out of phase. Well, they don't have to be 180 degrees out of phase. They can be 120 degrees out of phase, and so on. You can steer that null in three-dimensional space, or you can steer the peak. By changing the phase angle and the way you feed the two antennas, you're electronically steering the elevation beam. With that, you can now probe the atmosphere and figure out exactly what is the angle of arrival of that signal you're getting during that sporadic E opening on 6 meters. It'd be very nice to know, as a scientist, am I getting that signal on the horizon, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 8 degrees above the horizon? How is that signal getting to me? Electronically, you can find that out by using these techniques. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. Well, keeping with something like this. Question, really. Because I'm trying to now iron out some of these, fill in some of the gaps that I observed or maybe didn't quite understand. Stacking this, if I stack, according to all the so-called antenna makers at the time, if you stack 2.5 wavelengths apart, you're automatically in the ballpark. In other words, you don't have to worry about any kind of peculiarity of reaction between them, local field or anything like that. Is that true, that the 2.5 wavelength is a standard stick that you can say, oh, well, I can just do this and I'm in the ballpark and I don't have to worry about anything else, Dick, over?
It's almost like asking, will we all be happy if we marry a blonde lady? The answer is no. The correct stacking distance is primarily a function of the gain of the antenna. A higher gain antenna has a bigger capture area, and you must stack a further distance. 2.5 wavelengths maybe is the right stacking distance for an antenna where the boom is 5 wavelengths long. I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's something like that. And if you're willing to then go back and build a Yagi with a boom that's 10 or 15 wavelengths long, is 2.5 wavelengths of stacking distance right? Absolutely not. As the Yagi gets longer and longer, the opportunity for cross-coupling between the two gets greater and greater. So there's a brand new stacking distance for each length of boom of a well-designed Yagi. By the way, if you're foolish enough to design a Yagi poorly, and even though you've got a 5 wavelength boom and you think the right stacking distance is 2.5 wavelengths, if your design is poor enough, so if the gain is low enough, you can stack more closely together. You've got a smaller effective capture area. That's what the lower gain is because of the poor design of the antenna. Don't go there, but it's interesting to know. So is 2.5 the ideal stacking distance? Only for a certain boom length and shorter. Beyond that boom length, a brand new stacking distance should be used, in my opinion, Mel. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, keeping with this question. Stacking two Yagi. Does it automatically improve low-angle system performance? And does that also mean that you have to go to a higher mass? In other words, do you have to automatically have to raise up the whole situation if you want to achieve this takeover?
I think the answer is both yes and no. If I have a certain... If I have a single Yagi, I have a particular vertical beam width. Most of the time, I'm going to hit the peak of that, I'm going to set the peak of that beam on the horizon, because 98% of the time, the strongest signal from over the horizon comes to me from what looks like right on the horizon. That's where the signal appears to come from. So I'm going to set my antenna aimed right at the horizon, and that single Yagi has a certain vertical beam width. That vertical beam width might be 25 or 30 degrees. The bottom 15 degrees is looking at the Earth. The upper 15 degrees is looking at cold sky. The bottom 15 degrees of the beam width is looking at the Earth, is bouncing a signal off that Earth. The bounce signal plus the direct signal gives me a complicated radiated pattern in space. I now have a whole bunch of minor vertical lobes because of the interferometry of the ground bounce plus the real. The ground bounce really means that my antenna is, let's say, 30 feet above the ground. I have a real antenna 30 feet above the ground. I have a mirror image of that antenna, out of phase, 30 feet below the ground. That's what the ground bounce is giving you, that effect. And you could work out the mathematics of that, the geometry of that, and figure out what the resultant pattern is like in space. And it tends to give you a little bit of a null on the horizon. So your vertical beamwidth angle, the first major lobe of your vertical pattern is a function of how many wavelengths the antenna is off the ground and whether or not there is ground reflection in front of your antenna. Water in particular would really give you a significant one, particularly when you have a very calm sea state. If you can have anechoic material out in front of the antenna, in theory you can stop the ground bounce, but boy, that's difficult. Okay, now I vertically stack the antenna, a second Yagi, and my previous 30-degree vertical beamwidth now becomes 10 degrees of vertical beamwidth, plus and minus 5 degrees. Now the total amount of energy I'm sending in that lower 5 degrees that hits the ground is lower. So therefore, I have a brand new vertical pattern because of my pair of Yagis above the ground and the mirror image of them below the ground. I have, by the very nature of the pattern of the stacking of the two Yagis, I changed the vertical beamwidth, I changed the magnitude of the signal I've sent to the ground. And because I've got electronic steering capability, and this is something that AIL filed a patent on, Dr. Warren White of AIL filed a patent for a technique for radar performance improvement in which he had vertical stacking of feed horns in front of a dish antenna, and he electronically adjusted the signals in the feed horns such that he steered the null on the ground bounce. And therefore the radar worked much better when it was looking at an airplane that's above the horizon. He got rid of the ground bounce that was creating the cancellation. It was called a ground bounce canceller. So he electronically steered a null in the direction of the ground bounce to stop the ground bounce from giving him a disadvantage. You were on the threshold of doing that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. One of the observations that I found that really was very peculiar to me, no doubt that the two antennas did give me much better forward gain, I'm sure, because I solicited stations on one, two, both and all that, and the first times I even used to think that maybe, you know, it was just the conditions and all that I was listening on the bus. I noticed one thing that seemed to always work out, and that is, why did I get a deterioration in the front-to-back ratio then? Why did I get that? I saw with a single antenna I could have a front-to-back ratio that was anywhere 35 dB, sometimes 40 dB. With the two antennas in a stacked arrangement, why did the front-to-back drop to, like, maybe 25 dB? I could never understand what was really taking place. Why is the, if the forward gain was so-called improving, would that normally mean that the front-to-back deteriorates, Dick? Is that a normal situation, over?
Okay, again, you use good common sense. Good common sense would tell me that if I got a well-tuned single Yagi, and I've got a front-to-back ratio of, say, 30 dB, and I got a certain amount of forward gain, if I took that Yagi design and took the reflector and ripped it off that antenna, common sense would lead you to believe the front-to-back ratio that used to be 30 dB is going to degrade to some very low number, and the forward gain is going to come down by 3 dB because all of that energy used to go to the back hemisphere that the reflector reflected forward. You would say that, hey, now all of that back hemisphere of energy is going to go out there, and I'm going to lose 3 dB of forward gain. I have done that experiment. Rip away the reflector. Forward gain goes down by 0.2 dB. The standing wave ratio of the driven element changes, but you can recompensate for that. The front-to-back ratio that used to be 30 dB goes to 24 dB. And you say, how in the world can that happen? The majority of the front-to-back ratio is being generated by the majority of the parasitic elements. You've got a zillion directors out there. They're working real hard. They're doing all the work. The reflector is one of the significant parasitic elements. but it's not the only one. The forward director string is doing 90-some-odd percent of the work. Only 10% of the work is being done by the reflector. Eliminate the reflector, the antenna doesn't die. That's fact number one. Fact number two, the second antenna, vertically stacked above, which you're not feeding, its presence is picking up some of the signal being radiated by the first antenna, the lower one. But it's picking it up broadside. It's picking it up with crazy phase angles. Therefore, of the signals it re-radiates, some of it's forward and some of it's reversed. But because it's picking up the energy from the lower antenna with crazy phase angles, it's picking it up from the wrong direction. The upper antenna is carefully designed to mold the energy that comes down the boom from the boresight direction. It has been designed to handle that energy correctly. It has not been designed to handle the energy it receives broadside from the lower Yagi. Therefore, it behaves in a peculiar manner. It is re-radiating that signal. It's re-radiating some of it forward, some of it reverse. But because it's being fed in a peculiar manner, it has an extremely different front-to-back ratio when it's being fed in that manner. It's not being fed from the driven element. Each one of the parasitic elements are all sucking up a little bit of the energy from the lower antenna with crazy phase angles. So now the resultant pattern is very different than it was before in front-to-back. Forward gain, if you measure the delta of forward gain because of the presence of the second parasitic Yagi, the one that's passive, it's going to make a 1/10 of a dB of difference in forward gain. But since front-to-back ratio is such a careful balancing act, and you've disturbed that balancing act, you can make a whole lot of dB of change in front-to-back ratio without making any substantial difference in forward gain. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay. Saying was that if I had the means at the time to separate the two Yagis and rotate them individually, in other words, let's say I turn the lower one directed towards the station, run them in parallel, but be able to rotate the second one by itself. In other words, keep the bottom one, say, in one position and just adjust the top one. Could I actually now increase, let's say for a contest, you know, I want a much wider coverage, could I actually still get some effect, you know, with the beams and everything? I mean, would that ever a viable situation to rotate two Yagis on the same frequency independently, Dick, over?
Absolutely, and I've done that. And I'm not the only person to do it. I saw a website recently where a guy showed an arrangement where he did that. This was a serious contest operation, and the guy could independently rotate the Yagi. For instance, if I was doing a very serious operation on 432, I would aim most of my Yagis toward Boston, because that's where a lot of activity came from. I aimed some of my Yagis toward Philadelphia, because the pack rats down there, and that's where some of the activity came from. And electronically, I could flip between the Boston antennas and the Philadelphia antennas. I could rapidly go from back. In other words, I would have the antenna aimed toward Boston. I would work all the guys in Boston. I would hear a weak signal off the back lobe of the Boston antenna on 432 from Philadelphia. I'd flip over to the Philadelphia antenna, and now the guy is strong, and I'd work him immediately. Whereas if I had to rotate the antenna from Boston toward Philadelphia, and it took 40 seconds to do it, 40 seconds later in a contest, he may not be there anymore. He may have jumped to the 1296 band. You got to get him while he's there. So by flipping back and forth with my electronic switching, with some of those Yagis aimed in various directions, I could do that. Then if the guy in Philadelphia, I'm off the back of his antenna, and he doesn't hear me, then I take the time to rotate the Boston antennas toward him, and I transmit with both sets of antennas, Boston and Philadelphia, simultaneously aimed at him. I blowtorch him. I go up 3 or 6 dB more in power, and now he hears me off the back of his antenna, and he gives me an answer. I've done that. A lot of fun. Now, in your particular case, if for some reason you want a great front-to-back ratio, all you had to do, Mel, is to recognize the fact that your second passive Yagi was disturbing the front-to-back ratio because it was picking up a little bit of signal and re-radiating it. You could have transmitted 10% of your power, into the so-called passive antenna, properly adjust the phase, and you could have made the front-to-back ratio perfect. You could have tuned for a 40 dB null in the back antenna and only sacrificed 0.2 of